The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not because they are easy,
but we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Monday Space Show program. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in. Let me run through our announcements real quickly and then up and running with our program. Remember, you can call us and talk to our guest, 866-687-7223. No call screeners. Let it ring until it can be answered. I'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can use email. Just use drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then remember that everything we do is trademarked and copyrighted, but you do have permission to download shows and share them and pass them around. So please take advantage of that. Help get the word out as to why space and the topics we talk about on the Space Show are so important to everybody. We podcast with gigadial.net, and you can find the RSS URL on our website and our newsletter. We're in iTunes, Zune, Podcast Alley, Yastro.com, a host of other places, so please do check it out. And then our website, thespaceshow.com, you'll find the comprehensive newsletter there, and it has all of the information, the upcoming shows, and it's also where we make announcements and change things if we have to do that. You can also easily subscribe to the very short, condensed email newsletter. And then everything we do is archived. You can hear all the programs going back to 01 off of our website, or you can download them. You'll see a store on our website. Check it out. It's called Space Show Gear. And above all, you'll see the Support the Space Show button. Do remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with One Giant Leap Foundation. Could not be doing this show without your financial gifts and support. So keep it up, and thank you very much for making the Space Show available. And then do remember also that the Space Show is brought to you in part by Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. You can get a lot more information about them at their website, secureworldfoundation.org. So it's been almost a year since Eric Lerner was our guest. He's been on just about every year for the past several years. He is president of Lawrenceville Plasma Physics, and he has Focus Fusion. And we talk with him about what's happening in the fusion industry. Mr. Lerner has been very active in the DPF research for more than 25 years. He's developed a detailed quantitative theory of the functioning of DPF. We're going to be talking about that again. Based on his theory, he proposed that DPF could achieve high ion and electron energies at high densities, suitable for advanced fuel fusion and space population. He also is a participant in cosmology studies and sort of an alternative views of cosmology. We'll get to that later in the program. And so, Eric, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you?
Wow. Hi. Thanks for inviting me.
Always a pleasure, always a pleasure. Do we have fusion yet?
Well, we have fusion reactions. We've had fusion reactions for years. Do we have net energy yet? No.
Are we close?
I think we're pretty close, yeah. I think we're making good progress.
So later this year we'll have net energy?
Well, I hate to keep making schedule promises, but we are hopeful that it will be very soon.
Where are we? As I told you before the show started, you were last on in April of 2010. So are there highlights? What's happened in the year since you were on the program that you can tell us about? Have you crossed any milestones? What keeps you going?
Okay, yeah, we have made some real progress in the last year, even though not, it's true, as fast as we had hoped. but we are moving in the right direction. There are a few highlights. First of all, when we started this particular project, which was in the fall of 2009, one of our first goals was to try and confirm the promising results we've gotten a decade ago at Texas A&M University, in which we felt we had achieved very high temperatures, very high confined energies, and high density. And we wanted to go beyond that because we realized that in Texas, we had a very low efficiency of energy transfer into the little plasma that where the energy is produced. And let me just say for background, and I don't know whether everybody remembers back last year, this is a very small device, the plasma focus. It's the core of the device is inches across. And what it does is it uses strong currents within the plasma to self-concentrate the magnetic fields and the plasma into a tiny ball, which is called a plasmoid. It is confined for only billionths of a second, but reaches high density and high temperature. So what had happened by April was that we were getting the first indications that once again, we had achieved this very high energies, but we hadn't been we hadn't gotten most of our instruments online by that time, and I would say we'd only gotten probably a half dozen instruments. We're now functioning, and our instrumentation is growing leaps and bounds, so this might even be out of date today. We're just functioning now with about 15 instruments looking at each shot. And one of the big accomplishments is that we've gotten the highest resolution pictures ever of the plasmoid. And we've shown that it is about the size, a little bigger than we want and expect, but it's about the size we want and expect, and it's very much the shape, which what we did was we took photographs with an ICCD camera. ICCD camera is actually based on the same principles as a general video camera, but it's extremely fast exposure. The exposure is 1/50 of a billionth of a second. Very expensive camera. We paid $65,000 for it. And we took a picture with this camera, several pictures, that basically show that the plasmoid has formed exactly as we theorized by the filament kinking itself up. It just overtwists just like a telephone cord and kinks itself up into this little plasmoid. And we could see the kinks very clearly in the picture, which had a resolution of about 30 microns. So that was very significant. The other significant thing was the size was the radius of the core was about 100 to 200 microns. Now, we're expecting that with full compression, it would be compressed to about 60 microns. So this is a little bigger and less dense than we expect, but it's in the ballpark. So that was one big accomplishment.
So, for those of us that are laymen, how do we interpret this? What are you telling us? Can you put it in sort of layman terms so we can get psyched up and jazzed?
Well, the whole idea that is extremely exciting to us is we're talking about concentrating energy to a very extreme degree. We're starting out with energy stored in big capacitors that are spread over a small room. So the energy is stored in an area like 8 feet by 8 feet. At the end of this process, which is a pulse of electricity lasting a few million, most of that energy is temporarily concentrated in an air volume that's, I have to tell you in metric, and then we can translate, less than a millimeter long and less than a couple of hundred microns across. In inches, that becomes less than a 25th of an inch long and less than a few thousandths of an inch across. So that's the exciting thing, is that we can demonstrate that we can concentrate the energy to that extent. Is that clear?
Very clear. We'll see if anybody has questions as we move through the show.
And the second thing, as I say, is this idea of twisting, which is we, going into this experiment, we had a theory of how, we had, I think, what was a pretty good theory of how the plasmoid formed, which was basically exactly how a kink on your telephone line, if you still happen to have a landline.
Yeah, that's what I'm using right now, and it has lots
well,
of kinks in it.
Right, well, you we should use a landline, so I hope not everybody switches over to cell phones. But if you just twist your telephone wire sufficiently, you know it's going to kink up into a little ball at some point because of the overstress. And that's exactly what happens, is that the filament, which is carrying all this current through the plasma, kinks up into this little ball. And this is the first time we've seen this happen in the dense plasma focus. Now, we've seen it happen elsewhere, which is on the sun, because the process that we use in the plasma focus is actually a natural process that occurs in nature on several scales. The next jump up from what we're doing is upward-going lightning bolts that are called sprites that occur in our upper atmosphere. And the next step, big step up from that, is solar flares, which are frequent processes on the sun, explosions that can affect our communications here on Earth. And the next step up from that is astrophysical phenomena such as quasars, which is where our theoretical understanding of what was happening in the plasma focus originally came from. So it's also very exciting to us to actually have pictures where, yeah, we see the kinked helical filaments.
So here's your first question, okay? This is from our friend Todd in San Diego by email. So I understand what you're talking about, although I'm clearly not an engineer and I'm not in your league. But here's my question. Why are you able to come up with these kinds of results, or maybe I should say clues to achieving net on fusion, when the big multi-million-dollar or even billion-dollar tokamak reactors don't report such findings?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, basically, to get to a goal, you have to be heading in the right direction. If you're heading in the wrong direction, it doesn't matter what sort of resources you have. I mean, we have long been critical of the direction taken by the Department of Energy fusion program and by the programs of the EU and Japan, and because basically they made a very serious mistake 35 years ago, and that mistake was to narrow the range of possibilities, the approaches to fusion, to the tokamak at a time in which it was extremely premature to do so. If they had continued looking at other approaches, then I don't think the fusion program would be in the mess that it is now. And, in fact, it probably would have reached success by now. Our approach differs from theirs in a number of fundamental ways. The most important is that their approach attempts to make the plasma stay still. The way I put it is that they want it to sit like a good dog. And that's just impossible. Plasmas in the universe anywhere are inherently unstable for a very simple reason, which is well known, which is that if you have currents moving through a plasma, if those currents are moving in the same direction, they attract each other. They're moving in opposite directions, they repel each other. That's a prescription for instability. You get filamentation, where the currents twist together into filaments, and you get inherent instability. So the plasma-focused device, which we work on, and which people have been working on for quite some time, but 40 years, really, but very underfunded, takes the opposite standpoint. We say, let's use the instabilities that are natural to the plasma and devise a device such that each instability concentrates the energy further from the previous instability. And we're basically imitating something that the plasmas we know do in nature, most spectacularly, as I say, with solar flares. So by taking this approach, we get away from the idea that we have to stabilize it. And the plasmoid itself is not stable. It's what we call metastable. It only exists for a few thousand revolutions. But that's the other difference. We're looking at plasmas that are so dense that they have to be confined for only a few thousand orbits of their ion. So we're not trying to achieve the absolute stability that the tokamak guys are trying to achieve. And finally, we're using a device that is inherently cheap and compact. I mean, our device, with all of its instrumentation, took $500,000 to build. And that means, first of all, we're looking at an energy source that, when it's built, will be reasonably cheap and reasonably compact. And second of all, it means, you know, that we can do experiments a lot more cheaply than they can, approximately 1,000 times more cheap.
Do you
so,
get... Go ahead.
The short answer is they can't get as far as we can with 1,000 times more resources because they're heading in the wrong direction.
But of course, they keep heading in the wrong direction, don't they? Because they keep doing it.
You know, it's gone way beyond the point where these are scientific questions. This is a question of institutional inertia. I mean, once the path was set, at a certain point, it becomes very hard to change it because you have so many institutional structures heading in that same direction. Obviously, the contractors who are involved in the ITER, or as I prefer to pronounce it in the French way, ITER project, because it eats everybody else's budget. You know, some people are making money from this. This is a $20 billion project, and those people have influence on governments. And at a certain point, it's really institutional momentum. And I have a concrete example of that, which was the DOE made a decision decades ago not to fund the dense plasma focus, and it was part of their series of decisions not to fund this, not to fund that, which ultimately meant not to fund anything except the tokamak. And at one point, a potential investor of ours called up an official with DOE and discussed this with them. why they weren't funding. And they quoted some of the discussion back to it, to us. And one of the things they said was, well, we decide to fund things basically on what we think has the best chance of success. So the potential investor's agent asked, well, how do you decide that? And the guy said, well, one of the fundamental criterion we use is how successful the project has been in acquiring funding. So in other words, we fund what we funded in the past. And, you know, the potential investor was sort of astonished at the tight circularity of that argument. But that's what we're up against right now. Is there's a very strong institutional bias, and it creates fear because all of the funds are basically in one pot. And it means if you criticize the direction that DOE is going in, well, maybe you won't get any funds.
So do you get federal funding for Focus Fusion, or are you all privately funded?
Well, at the moment, we're privately funded. This is absolutely not by choice. We originally got government funds, NASA funds, from 1994 to 2001. And then NASA was basically ordered to get out of the fusion business, which they had to do, and everybody, including us, was cut off. And that's why when we started raising private funds, we still hope to get government money in the future. But, you know, raising this money privately is a very slow process. It took us actually 8 years after our experiments in 2001 to raise enough money for another set of experiments. So that's really a huge waste of time. And right now, our progress is still limited by funding.
Bill is in Denver, Colorado, by email. And again, listeners, toll-free number 866-687-7223. Bill says, I'm a bit confused only because I don't know that much about fusion, although I sure wish it were here. Is your project the same one I hear about from time to time where the Navy is doing some work on fusion with Dr. Broussard's ideas for fusion?
No, it's not the same project, but we do have something in common, which is another difference between us and the tokamak approach. We haven't started using this fuel, but our goal is to use a fuel that consists of hydrogen and boron. And that's the same fuel that the group that was headed by Dr. Broussard is also hoping to use, and a third group in California called TriAlpha Company. Now, all of us are using different devices, but we have in common this fuel. Now, why this fuel? Well, the problem with the fuel that the tokamak people are using, which is deuterium plus tritium, is that when it reacts, it produces most of its energy in the form of a high-speed neutron. And the only way people have ever figured out of getting energy out of the neutron is to do what people have been doing since Edison, which is use an energy source to boil water to produce steam, to drive a turbine, to drive a generator, which is very expensive. So you'll never get cheap energy that way. And second of all, that high-energy neutron produces radioactive activity, so you don't get away from the radioactive waste problem, although you enormously reduce it compared with fission. Now, boron plus hydrogen at a high enough temperature fuse together to very briefly form a carbon nucleus. It has too much energy to stay together. It breaks apart into 3 helium nuclei. The good thing about this is that no neutrons are released. And what you get is the energy in the form of moving charged particles. So you can convert the energy directly into electricity without first converting it into heat. And that potentially can make your conversion much, much cheaper, and therefore the entire process much So that's another big reason why we think we're heading in a better direction. And that's something that we have in common with the project that you're talking about, which is a company called EMC Squared. And they are getting government money. They're the one project that is, which is, as you say, from the Navy.
Kelly Starks has an email question for you. I've heard that there are limits to how large you expect a focus fusion device, but that it's easier to make small than, say, a Polywell design. So I'm wondering how big would a reactor be for various output power outputs, say a kilowatt, megawatt, gigawatt, and how small a reactor looks feasible, say, to power an airliner, a semi, I guess that's a truck, and a car.
Well, this is a pulse device. So how much power we get out of it depends really on how rapidly we pulse it. Each pulse produces a very small amount of energy. We expect something in the order of 50 kilojoules. Now, 50 kilojoules would, that's a 100-watt light bulb for 10 minutes. Small amount of energy. So the question is, how fast can we pulse it? Or how slowly, if we want a small amount of energy? Well, you don't want to pulse it too slowly because the plasma will cool off so much that the boron will not remain gaseous. And that will create a lot of problems if you kept having the boron played out every shot. But you can't pulse it too rapidly because, as I said, this is a very small device. Like any device, it has waste heat. You have to get that waste heat out. So at a certain point, you won't be able to. So we estimate the optimal size is about 5 megawatts. And physically, this would be something like a 3-ton device that would be perhaps a couple of meters, a couple of yards across. So that's very compact for a generator with that power. You could fit it into practically anything except a car. You obviously don't want a 3-ton engine for a car. We do expect that it could be fit into a truck, although we suspect you don't drive a truck with 5 megawatts. That's a ridiculous amount of energy for a truck. We suspect that for cars and trucks, the best thing would be for them to be electric, and then you charge them up using focus fusion generated electricity. For larger vehicles, like a ship, it would be perfectly suitable to have focus fusion generators on board. So that's basically where it is.
What about an airplane? Would that be feasible for a plane to have something like that on board?
It's much more challenging because you are talking about something that can crash. And I was saying that the main reaction produces no neutrons, which is true. But there is a very secondary reaction that produces a small amount of a very short-lived radioactive element called carbon-11. That has a half-life of, I believe, something like 20 minutes. So that doesn't really bother you as long as it's inside the device. And, in fact, the device could be opened only 9 or 10 hours after it was turned off. You wouldn't need any protection whatsoever. It would be back to background. But if you had this flying in a plane, there probably would be safety considerations. So let me put it this way. It's an open question. One thing that you could do if you had these unlimited amounts of electric energy is replace planes with one of my favorite ideas, which is actually an old idea, is maglev trains in evacuated tunnels. This was thought up back in the 1970s. If you have a magnetic levitation train an evacuated tunnel, you can actually go up very rapidly to suborbital speed, and it gets you there a lot quicker than in the airplane. There's a significant capital cost in digging all those tunnels through the Rockies, but I think in the long term, having so many airplanes in the air, probably not very practical either.
Another email's from Las Vegas. Charles is there. And he says, reactions other than boron, proton, possibly lithium-7, proton, fluorine, proton. Wouldn't it be easier to use deuterium, ritium, in spite of the neutrons? That reaction goes so much more readily. Would not in any reaction much of the output as bremsstrahlung X-rays? I may be mispronouncing that.
Bremsstrahlung.
That's his question. I guess you understand what he's asking you.
Well, it's a little, okay.
It's a little convoluted,
so.
Yeah.
By the way, at some point I want to get back to our, I haven't gone through our accomplishments so far.
After this one, we'll go back to that, okay?
I mean, one of the things that we have not yet demonstrated experimentally, but our equations tell us, is that the amount of compression goes up as the atomic mass and atomic charge of the gas we're using goes up. So there are actually advantages to using the heavier elements such as boron, which would not be so evident with lithium. Part of the problem, lithium does not actually burn all that much easier than hydrogen boron. The thing with lithium is that there's actually a cycle of reactions that started if you start with lithium. So it's a lot more complicated. Right now, we're using pure deuterium as an experimental gas because it's very simple to study. And we hope that the next step, which we hope to initiate sometime this summer, would be going directly to hydrogen boron. So if that works, you probably don't have to worry about lithium. Now, in terms of bremsstrahlung, we calculate that about a third of the energy will be released in the form of X-rays. For those who don't know this German term, bremsstrahlung means breaking. And this is breaking radiation, as in stepping on the brakes, which occurs when electrons in a hot plasma encounter ions, and that changes their direction, slows them down, and that causes them to emit radiation. Now, that radiation is about a third of the energy we expect. Two-thirds comes out in the beam. And we do intend to capture that radiation in a sort of fancy photoelectric device with thousands of layers of metal to capture that energy efficiently.
You have a caller on hold, so can we do the call and then go back to your accomplishments?
Sure.
Okay. Caller, are you with us, please?
It's Charles. You invited me to call. So
yeah, we just asked.
Yeah, I just heard your questions. I was controlling the knob on the speaker.
Yeah. So no, did he answer it okay to you?
He answered the. I just heard him answer the Bernstrahlung question, saying that about one third of the total power was coming out of the X-rays.
Right.
And that is whether a reaction is happening or not. It's simply the plasma temperature causing that. And then. What about other potential proton reactions like lithium-7 and fluorine, oddly enough, has a kind of a enhanced resonance?
Right. Yeah, that's what we did discuss earlier.
Okay, I missed it. Yeah.
Right. I mean, just in brief, there are advantages. We do anticipate that the heavier elements like boron will actually lead to a greater degree of compression.
Yeah. And what about fluorine? F-19. That makes oxygen and helium.
Right. But the cross-section of that is, I mean...
Okay.
The cross-section, at the temperatures we're talking about, the cross-section of that is way down.
Okay.
Matter of fact, I don't even know whether what I don't even know what the minimum energy is for fluorine. It's pretty high.
There's some kind of a resonance, so the minimum energy is somewhat less than most proton reactions.
Yeah.
But anyway, you're talking about billions of degrees peak temperature to start the reaction, right?
Right.
And why not, in spite of the neutrons, the deuterium-tritium reaction, and then just deal with the neutrons? Because there's going to be a lot of heat output anyway. The X-ray
well, but,
has to
but
be
the problem
to
is, if there's two problems. Again, with the light elements, we don't get the same compression. So it's not simply that they burn easily. But the big thing that you lose two big things with DT. One is you are not going to get cheaper energy. Once you put all of your energy into a steam cycle,
yeah.
There's a certain minimum of capital cost you have to put in, which, I mean, in a conventional nuclear fission reactor, 80% of the capital cost is incurred after you've produced the energy.
Yeah, but you could then cite
that
reactor.
That's going to get away from our basic goal of cheap, clean energy. And the clean, you sort of give up, too, because if you're producing 14 MeV neutrons, you can't get away from producing long-lived radioactive elements.
Now you may be able to. If you avoid high atomic number elements in the neutron flux, you would be left only with very small amounts of carbon-14, and you would be using up the neutrons to breed tritium out of lithium anyway. So neutrons would be controlled.
Yeah. But I think the technical, as I say, the engineering challenges of getting something that is cheap.
Yeah.
Once you use DT fuel, I don't think they can be overcome.
That reaction goes like 100 times more rapidly than any of the proton reactions.
Not at very high temperature. It's more like a factor. At very high temperature, it's more like a factor of 10.
Yeah, but you
and
can
that's
make
what
50
we've
million.
Proven. We can, I mean, to go back to the accomplishment,
yeah.
We've demonstrated two of the three elements, or actually, three of the four elements that we need.
Uh-huh.
We've demonstrated the very high temperature. We can reach 200 keV, which is 2 billion degrees.
Yeah,
so we're not worried about that. We have the confinement time, because we're looking for a confinement time of only 7 to 10 nanoseconds, and the confinement time in our experiments now are about 30 to 50 nanoseconds. So we're well beyond that. And this is the point that I haven't talked about, which is we have achieved relatively high efficiency. We are now putting about 10% of the total kinetic energy into the plasmoid. Now, that's not the 100% that we hope for, but it is an enormous improvement over what we were getting in Texas. So we're getting very close to having the efficiency we need. So that, I want to talk about that a little bit more later in the show, but that high efficiency.
Okay, well, that concludes my questions. I'll hang up and continue listening. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe. Eric, why don't we take our first break and pause and come back, and then let's go back into what you're talking about right now, okay?
Okay.
All right, so everybody stay where you are. We'll be back with Eric Lerner in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. You are listening to The Space Show. Our guest today, Eric Lerner. We're talking about Focus Fusion. So, Eric, let's continue on with your accomplishments, and then I'll bring in some more questions.
So that, I sort of introduced it, but I just want to emphasize that one of the big accomplishments we had over the last year is demonstrating that we can get a significant fraction of the total energy into the plasmoid and from the plasmoid into the beam. The plasmoid, as it decays, generates extremely high electric fields that accelerates an ion beam in one direction, an electron beam in the other. And we've been finally starting to measure these beams. And these beams are very energetic. These beams carry kilojoules of energy, and they deliver that in tens of nanoseconds. So these are, for the brief time that these beams are on, they're delivering gigawatts of power, comparable to what an entire generation station would produce. So that's a very important thing, because in the experiments we did a decade ago in Texas, we were estimating only about a tenth of a percent of the total energy was getting into these tiny plasmoids. And we knew that that was a problem that had to be resolved. And we think we've made really major steps in resolving that, and are now up into the 10 or perhaps tens of percent efficiency. So we're very much within shooting range of getting another notch up where almost all of the energy is going into the plasmoid. So that's clearly something we have to do. And I want to just mention in reference, for example, to some of the fusion projects people have heard more about, like the National Ignition Facility, the big laser project that has been in the news a lot, is that they have an extremely low efficiency, so that while they're talking about trying to achieve break-even, they mean break-even in terms of the energy provided by the lasers to the plasma compared with the fusion energy release. But they don't take into account the much larger, 1,000 times larger energy provided to the laser. What we're trying to do, and what we've succeeded in doing, is getting the energy transfer from the total energy supply to the device up into the tens of percent. Now, our fusion release is nowhere near that, but at least the energy is there. And as we get the density higher, which is the one element that we're missing, then we think that we'll rapidly approach the point where we have more fusion energy out than input.
You want to take some additional questions?
Sure.
Okay. So this is from Daniel. And Daniel's question is, does D plus HE3 hide the real plasmoid density? The full idea is on the Focus Fusion Society forum, and then he gives a URL for it. But it boils down to this: the presence of HE3, which is trapped around currents of 700 Ka, suppresses the D plus D reaction by inducing helium-3 plus D. Besides, it is autotronic reaction releasing ions at 14 MeV and 4 MeV, close to those registered in energy in the February report. What do you think? Would you take a look at the forums? I made some illustrations and put some more explanations up. Derek liked the idea. This goes to what we were talking about during the break with guys that have a big background and comment on the forum.
A little too technical to handle over the radio. I mean, I think what he's talking about is that you have a reactions with reactant products. One of the things we're looking for is evidence of deuterium reacting with tritium that's been produced by the DD reaction. And the way we can observe that, right, our reactions are deuterium plus deuterium. And deuterium plus deuterium half the time produces a nuclei of tritium. And then that tritium can interact with deuterium to produce a characteristic 14 MeV neutron. We're looking for those reactions because they're an indication of how dense the plasma is. Because the denser the plasma, the more likely those tritium nuclei have of reacting. So far, we haven't observed them. And we know why we're not getting as high a density as we want. So those secondary reactions, the DT, the DHE3, are way down right now until we get higher density. So we don't think that they're directly affecting our results. But I will reply at greater length on the forum.
So the... Why don't we pause for a minute and tell us what the forum is and how people can find it.
Okay. Well, first of all, the experiment is being done by a for-profit company called Lawrenceville Plasma Physics. But there's a non-profit organization, Focus Fusion Society, which educates people about us and about other forms of aneutronic fusion. On that website, which is focusfusion.org, you can see very prominently displayed forums. And if you join the forums, you know, the normal registration stuff, you'll see lots and lots of discussions going on, some of which are policy discussions, some of which are very technical discussions. So, of course, people can join in there. Now, I personally cannot reply to all of these comments. I can't even read all of these comments. I mean, I would guess there are about 20 or 30 comments a day. But I do try and dip into it as much as I can.
Okay, yeah, it's very hard to have a job and to do this and then follow forums and post, you know, comments and replies to everybody. I have a hard time doing it with the Space Show blog, and it's a lot less
right.
traffic than what you're getting. You have another caller. Hi, caller. Are you with us, please? Hello? Caller, are you there?
Sorry, the mute was on. I apologize.
Okay, who are you?
This is Dave in Cleveland.
Oh.
I apologize if this was asked because I missed the first half of the program, but their recent NASA research announcement on early-stage innovation, advanced concepts, where they focus on wanting the crazy ideas from TRLs 1 through 3. Are you guys planning, can you tell us, on submitting any proposals for that?
I can't honestly say whether we will or not. I mean, I did look at it very briefly. I'm not sure whether fusion is going to be allowed. The amount of money is reasonably small compared with our current needs. I believe it's up to $100,000. And unfortunately, right now we go through that in a month. So we'd have to carefully consider whether this is a wise use of our time, because these proposals actually take a great deal of time and effort. So I I can't answer that, but I am aware of the...
Can you rig the game, Dave?
I am not involved, as you know, so I just am someone who would like to see a solar system travel sometime while I'm still alive, David.
Can I ask you, have you read the proposal in detail? Does it include fusion?
No, and I don't think, and I'm just guessing now, that that was at the top of anyone's mind when they had that. But, you know, you can't let things like that stop you. The main decision you got to make is whether, for a potential reward of only initially $100K, is it worth the substantive time you have to put into it. However, you know, some of us are working and pushing internal to the system things like closer in, like propellant depots and all that stuff, but we still don't open up the solar system to realistic travel without something like a space-usable fusion drive. And I think that that is at, is not impossible in what remains of my lifetime, even within remains of Dave's lifetime.
But I I suspect that it will be easier to get the government money after we've gone through this initial, well, it's not initial, but this current research phase, once we can demonstrate scientific feasibility. Hopefully the government will be embarrassed into changing course and will say, oh, yeah, we'll help you develop, do the engineering, because the engineering, of course, costs a lot more money than the research. And there are separate engineering problems that go with space applications, because I was mentioning that we're limited by how much heat we can pull out of the machine. Of course, in a space application, the limitation is also that you have to get rid of that heat by radiating it. So if you don't want enormous radiators, you have to devote a lot of engineering cleverness to how compactly you can radiate that. So all that good engineering work, we certainly think the government should be paying for. But realistically, we'll probably have to get the scientific feasibility phase before they do.
Okay. Thank you very much, Eric.
Thanks, David. Listeners, that opens that line up. 866-687-7223. You got a very similar question from Trent in Australia, so I'm going to go ahead and read his question. It's right on the same lines of what Dave said, but with a little bit of a different twist. He says, how will this revolutionize space, being that you're on the space show and all of that? He says, I've asked this kind of question before, but I've not found the answer all that encouraging from people who know about fusion. So here's another space person wanting to know how you could actually use fusion to open up the solar system and to go through space. So I'm assuming at some point, if it exists, it can be used, correct?
Yes. I mean, obviously, once we develop it for energy production here on Earth, then, you know, we have to take on these other engineering challenges, then it certainly could be used for space travel. And there's no doubt that with fusion, we could achieve much higher speed. I mean, we did the study for NASA back, well, in the 90s, where you could make a trip to Mars in about 2 weeks. So this would certainly enormously speed the exploration of the solar system. Whether that means that the explorers will be human or whether they will continue to be robotic is actually another question, because it involves the question of, you know, are these areas where we have to keep a high degree of sanitation so we don't contaminate their life forms with ours? How do we deal with the fact that most of our destinations in the solar system are high radiation zones? So I'm not sure that this has a big impact on human exploration. but it would have enormous impact on robotic exploration. I mean, if you could plan a mission, put together a package, which might be very heavy, might weigh much more than the packages that can be delivered today, and then send it out to Mars in a couple of weeks, to Jupiter in a couple of months, you can imagine that the rate of exploration would jump by a factor of 10 or more.
Trent modified his question and sent it in and said, do you think focused fusion could be used to launch from the surface of the Earth?
Well, in theory, perhaps. I mean, you couldn't use it in the same way. In deep space, it would make sense to use the ion beam itself as the source of thrust. The ion beam is traveling something like 10,000 kilometers a second. So you could use that to get up to very high velocities. But the amount of thrust generated would not be very great, certainly not enough to get you off the Earth. However, you could, if you wanted to get off the Earth, you could use the fusion generator simply as a source of electricity and use the electricity to drive some magnetohydrodynamic thruster that would use a great deal more propellant. So that could get you off the Earth. And when I mean a great deal more propellant, I'm not talking about something more than perhaps a tenth of your payload. So you could use the first engine to get you off the Earth, and then a second engine that used the actual ion beam to get you to your destination.
Okay. It's time to take our second break. We're at the top of the hour. So everybody stay where you are. We'll be back in a couple of minutes with our final segment and more information from Eric Lerner.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. Welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Eric Lerner today, and we're talking about focused fusion. Eric Karen in Madison, Wisconsin, has this email question for you and says, last year during the space policy debate, the administration seemed to be pushing forward and putting funds forward to advance very different and radically more sophisticated propulsion. And while I don't think it was mentioned by name, I think there was a focus on Vasimir, which is a type of nuclear propulsion. Is there any way that focused fusion could be included in the kind of NASA policy that got debated last year and may still get implemented either for 11 or fiscal year 12?
Well, I think, you know, NASA has to make a policy decision that it's going to fund fusion again. That's the key thing. I have not heard that such a decision has been made. So that's the key policy decision we'd like them to make. And then, of course, once they decide that, then we can say, well, this is a good, cheap, lightweight way to produce fusion, which we think that we should start looking at some of the specific applications.
Why did NASA actually move away from a policy of funding fusion?
Well, no reason was ever given, to my knowledge. There was a lot of speculation that it was a policy put in from the top, that the administration simply did not want to encourage anything that competed with oil and gas. When you're funding fusion that's light enough to fit into a spacecraft, you're almost always going to be funding fusion that's also cheap, because small generally equals cheap. Nobody was thinking that tokamaks could fly. So NASA's fusion program was extremely important, because when DOE was not funding the alternatives, NASA was. So by cutting off NASA, you pretty much cut off the alternative. So obviously we can't prove this, but there was a lot of speculation that that was the reason. And the present administration has not made any changes to that policy that we've heard of. So it appears that it's still in place.
Harold, go ahead.
Who asked that question?
Karen.
Karen.
Yeah, in Madison, Wisconsin.
Okay. Can I ask Karen a question?
Yeah, but she's on by email, so it's not real time, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, you can just write this to Karen and ask if she's been involved in the protest in Madison. I hope she has. Because I think that, you know, one of the things that to draw back to the bigger picture, as people are aware, there's a big drive politically from both political parties to cut back on essential public expenditure. Research and development in clean energy is part of that picture. And the reason they're giving for these cutbacks is that we're out of money, which is not true. That's complete and utter lie. The problem is the government at the moment is giving away the money to a very small section of our population, which is the rich. And the battle that's going on, that I'm sure people are aware of, in Madison and the rest of several other Midwestern states, is precisely over this issue, where people are fighting whether public education is going to be gutted and public workers' incomes are going to be gutted in order to feed the rich. So I think I personally have been very encouraged by the fact that hundreds of thousands of people are now turning out to say this shouldn't happen.
So, Karen, if you're still listening and you want to give a comment or reply to Eric, or for that matter any other listeners, go right ahead. You all know how to do it. The toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. And, of course, email drspace@thespaceshow.com. And, you know, if I get a note from you or your phone call comes in, you'll have a priority. But you also have a question from Harold, who's in Las Vegas as well. And Harold says, what is the status of Sirius and quality fusion research in any other country, spacefaring country or just regular country?
Um,
Is anyone else doing serious fusion research?
Are you talking about research along our lines? Or?
Well, he didn't specify, but I would think that's probably what he's talking about. Is, are there any competing fusion projects outside the United States other than the big tokamak over in Europe?
Well, the device that I'm working on, that we here at LPP are working on, is called the Dense Plasma Focus. There are several groups, perhaps two dozen groups around the world, that are working on the same device. Not all of them have fusion as an immediate goal, but I think all the groups are interested in that as the ultimate goal. The actual probably most powerful device of the sort that we have is located in Warsaw, Poland. And there's another powerful device located in Iran, of all places. Matter of fact, they have quite an active dense plasma focus research activity there, a number of smaller machines as well. And then here in the United States, there's also a large machine located in Las Vegas. Now, and there are many machines located, smaller machines located in developing countries. Developing countries, universities like the DPF because it is so cheap, and therefore it can fit into a budget where you couldn't possibly think of making a significant contribution to a tokamak. So there is work similar to ours going on elsewhere. At the moment, we're the only focus fusion project, in a sense. We're the only dense plasma focus project that is also working toward a hydrogen-boron tool. But that is certainly there are a lot of projects going on around the world.
How are they funded, do you know? Are they government-funded in their countries?
Yes. They're all government-funded, as far as I know. We're probably the only privately funded one. I mean, the one in Las Vegas, I'm afraid, is a example of the irrationality of the government's funding priorities. I mean, it's very good that they are funding this, but an arm of the Department of Energy that is concerned with national security is funding a private company to run this very large dense plasma focus facility as a neutron source for basically defense. Applications to see how various pieces of equipment would withstand an atomic explosion. Now, they're actually doing something that's pretty similar to what we're doing. They're using a dense plasma focus with deuterium to produce neutrons through fusion reactions. So here the government, on the one hand, is funding someone to produce neutrons through fusion reactions, but they're unwilling to fund anyone to produce fusion reactions. So that's just totally irrational. Obviously, the government's aware of the fact that this is a good way to produce fusion reactions, but they won't fund it as part of their fusion program.
You have another caller. Caller, are you with us, please?
Yes, I am.
And you are? Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, you're on a bad phone line, so be quick.
Give me a second. I'm on a cell phone.
Well, it's horrible. We can barely understand you.
All right. How does it sound now?
Horrible. Give it a try, and let's see if we can hear your question.
All right. Okay. A while back, I was discussing with somebody the prospect of fusion rockets. And one of the things I was discussing about with the tokamak is that Basically, the tokamak is weighs about 100,000 tons. And for you to get a practical fusion rocket, you have to have, you got to get a better alpha than that. Alpha being the ratio between the power produced versus the weight of the reactor.
Right.
Is that something that you're working on with your, with this nuclear reactor? I mean, this fusion reactor?
That's down, our generator right now weighs something of the order of 3.
How much?
How much we missed?
3 tons.
3 tons, okay.
3 tons?
Right. So, now, if we were putting together a large fusion reactor, a large fusion rocket, we would probably try to set up a circuit in which a number of electrodes were fed from a single bunch of capacitors. Let me explain that. We have, when we fire our capacitors, we have a rise time of a couple of microseconds, and the whole cycle is about 8 microseconds long. Now, in terms of a single set of electrodes, we could not fire every 8 microseconds because of this cooling problem. The electrodes would melt. So we're talking about firing maybe 500 times a second, which arithmetic serves would be firing every 2,000 microseconds. So in theory, we could put a whole bunch of electrodes to feed off a single set of capacitors. And then we could have a much higher energy to mass ratio, because the capacitors are what weighs the most. So there are definitely ways in which we could get a higher energy to mass ratio. At the moment, the energy to mass ratio would be not that terrific, because we're talking about 5 megawatts or 3 tons. But in theory, we could go a lot higher by making the capacitors through a switching system. Not that they'd be attached to all the electrodes simultaneously, that wouldn't work. But if you had a switching system in which you fired the capacitor and fired electrode 1 and then electrode 2 and then electrode 3,
mm-hmm.
in theory, with the same weight, with the same mass, you could get, you know, orders of magnitude more energy.
Okay. So what's the progress of the reactor so far?
Well, that's what we've been discussing up to now. I guess you just...
I came in late. I just came back from work.
Yeah. I mean, to put it in a sentence, I think we've made a lot of progress over a year, and we're hoping over the next year or so to go all the way to the point where we can demonstrate scientific feasibility.
So you think by next year you can get break-even?
Well, we don't use the term break-even because people play around. Break-even is a ratio, and people play around a lot with the denominator of what you're dividing that by. What we say is scientific feasibility. What we mean is that we can prove in the lab that a generator should be able to produce net power once engineering problems are resolved. So that's what we're trying to get to, is that demonstration of scientific feasibility.
Okay, so you're going beyond break even to look for something that you can say you can actually hook up a generator up to and produce some usable power.
Well, what we're looking is to demonstrate scientifically that such a machine is possible.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're looking to do in the lab. And that would mean, you know, a very high amount of fusion energy relative to total input per shot. High enough so that with reasonable efficiencies of converting that energy, we could predict that we would still have net energy left over.
Okay.
We mean by scientific feasibility.
Oh, you mean proving that you can actually get a usable amount of energy out of it
right.
in a lab.
In a lab, right. And then we obviously have to. That, you see, is a short term. Then we need another 3 or 4 years and adequate funding to do the engineering to get that to a prototype generator that's firing 400 or 500 times a second.
Okay. Well, good luck. I hope you accomplish that because we
well,
definitely could use the power.
Yes, we could.
Yeah. I know that, you know, a 3-ton, 5-megawatt reactor, that would be perfect for a for the power system for a Mars manned Mars mission or a manned Mars moon base.
Well, to supply the power for you mean on the ground? Yes, yeah.
Yeah, on the ground or for the
power for the rocket itself, you need a great deal more than five.
Yeah, a lot of the some of the Mars mission planning is chemical rockets. But they use a nuclear reactor to provide electrical power for the systems.
Right, right. Yeah, that would certainly be cool.
Okay.
If you got, I was about to say, if you got that to work, you wouldn't have to worry about a lot of the political hang-ups that you would with fission.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you just still have to worry about the political hang-ups to get the money to go to Mars.
Any other?
You have to worry about radiation once you're on Mars, because if you stay out too long on Mars, you sort of get yourself caught.
You get radiated anyway, right?
That's a problem.
If you produce enough power, you might be able to generate a magnetic field to protect the crew from radiation.
Well, I looked at that a little bit, and you're really talking about enormous amounts of power. The reason why we're not getting cooked now, except for, of course, we also have the atmosphere, we have a very powerful generator, which is deep within the Earth, that's producing this magnetic field. It's not an insignificant amount of power. That would be somewhat hard to do. Anyway, lots of engineering to think about.
I got to move on, caller. Anything else?
No, I'll let y'all go. I'll let you get to the next person.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so that line is open, 866-687-7223. So this is Jane in Seattle and says, many people think the only way to do fusion is to go to the moon and get HE3. I haven't heard you talk about that at all. Do you have any comments on that idea?
Well, boron is a lot easier to get. We mine boron out of the ground. Hydrogen obviously comes from water. If focused fusion works, the amount of boron that we would need to fuel all of our energy needs is about 10% of what we're now producing. So a 10% increase in production would be enough to cover our boron fuel needs. Going to the moon to get HE3 is obviously an enormously ambitious and enormously costly enterprise. So it's best if we could do something that completely avoids that. And focused fusion would be a way of avoiding that.
And, of course, we're not going to the moon for that anytime soon, nor do we have the capability to do it.
No, we don't.
So you're talking about delays and timelines that are really pushed out there into the future.
Right.
You have another caller on hold. Caller, who are you, please?
It's Trent from Australia.
Hi, Trent. Welcome. Go ahead.
Hi, Trent.
So, I heard you recently,
isn't it?
Say again, please.
I said it must be very early in Australia.
It's about 9 a.m.
Oh. All right.
Go ahead.
So, I read your recent paper about the practical testing that you're doing, and I haven't seen a lot of people looking at it going, well, that's interesting. so I'm wondering when the next thing you're going to publish is, and what you think the first thing that you will publish is going to be that's going to ruffle a lot of feathers.
So you're referring to the Journal of Fusion Energy article? Well, that's hard to say. I mean, we don't actually know what feathers will get ruffled when. I am right now working on an article for submission to FISREF Letters about the achievement of our high energy, our high energy confinement. And basically, that would also address long-term objections that people have periodically raised, that the neutrons are not really coming from a plasmoid, but coming from a beam. And we think that we have very solid proof that's not the case. So hopefully I'll be submitting that this month. Sometimes hard to get the time in a very small project crew like we have to actually write these articles. So we'll see. I don't know whether it will ruffle feathers or it won't, or whether it will gain attention or not.
So I imagine when you publish the proof of scientific feasibility, that sort of paper, that there will be a lot of people who will be just completely surprised and we'll maybe have to rethink their approach to fusion in general.
Well, I think if we get to that point, we'll have to prove it six ways Sunday before anybody will publish it. Because obviously everybody's first reaction is, oh, yeah, if we claim that we have burn significant amounts of hydrogen boron at all, which nobody else has done. So we know that there will be a lot of skepticism prior to publication. It will be very difficult to get this published. And even if it's published in the prestigious journal, I'm sure the initial reaction will be skepticism. We'll have to overcome that. That's why we don't publish anything on our results with PV11 or even discuss anything on our results with PV11 until we think we have iron proof.
So I can imagine when you do publish that, there'll be a lot of people, doing good science, trying to reproduce your results. How do you plan to protect your investment?
Well, LPP does hold a patent on some of the advancements we've made on the dense plasma focus. So that's the basic protection we have with the U.S. patent, and we have patents applied for in various foreign markets. But realistically, I mean, we know that if this becomes the energy of the future, we won't. It's not a question that we'd hold a monopoly on it. We think that our investors will do very well as long as we get a substantial share of the market.
All right, thank you very much.
Thanks,
thank
Trent. Are investors, you're talking about private placement type of investors, and do they acquire stock or?
Yeah, the way we're raising money, we're privately held company, and by SEC regulations, we're limited to investors or so-called accredited investors who have $200,000 in income and $1 million in assets if they are American residents. If they're residents of some other country, they have to follow whatever restrictions or lack of restrictions they have in that country. So, yeah, we have raised money by selling shares to investors. These are non-voting shares. We don't want the company taken over by, let's say, Exxon or Mobil. So I own all the voting shares, But we do have a very rigid shareholders agreement that protects the financial interests of the investors.
We're coming up pretty much toward the end of the program, and so just briefly, as we turn to cosmology, which we always like to do when you're on the show, you told me to the break, during the break, that developments in this area are actually a bit slow for the year, correct?
Well, our own research has been pretty slow because I and my colleagues have been busy with other projects, including my project Fusion. We are still pushing ahead with what we think will be very exciting results in testing whether there's expansion in the universe at all using the surface brightness of galaxies. And I hope that we'll be submitting within the next couple of months a paper on that. So we hope to get some excitement from that. But other than that, things have been fairly slow.
And you've mentioned a couple of locations where people can follow your cosmology work, correct?
Right. I'm part of a group of researchers called the Alternative Cosmology Group, and that has a website which is cosmology.info. And we're putting out a monthly newsletter which can keep people up to date on what's happening.
The best way for people to stay informed on your Fusion efforts and of what you're doing, how do you recommend that?
Well, we have the website I mentioned, which is the focusfusion.org website, and we also have, which is, I think, probably the most informative. That's a very educational website. And we also have the company's website, which is LawrenceVillePlasmaPhysics.com.
Okay. So next year, scientific feasibility, right?
We hope so.
When you're on the show. Okay.
That's right.
We'll all be hoping that it happens.
Okay. Well, good to talk to you again.
Thank you. Unless there's anything else that we've forgotten to talk about or anything you wanted to make sure we updated today, or are we good to go?
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Eric.
Okay.
Bye. So that's our Fusion update annually with Eric Lerner doing hot stuff, and it's very, very exciting. So I do urge all of you to check out those websites, focusfusion.org, LawrenceVillePlasmaPhysics.com, and stay informed. And we'll look forward to talking to Eric again in about a year. Tomorrow night, open lines. You don't want to miss it. We're going to have some fun, especially with this YouTube video that our buddy Trent in Australia created. I'll give you a little glimpse if you haven't seen it, because it's making the rounds, and let's see if I can find it real quick. So it's making the rounds, and it's a video about member of the House Science Committee, and by the way, it's very current, March 2nd, Dana Rohrabacher, who's from Orange County, California, and he's questioning the NASA administrator, Charlie Bolden, on a couple of things about commercial space and stuff. I don't really want to tell you anything more about it, but you ought to check it out. It'll bring a smile to your face, but in a way it's also kind of sad. Go to YouTube, and here's your search code. Rohrabacher, R-O-H, R-A-B as in boy, A-C-H-E-R, pitches, like baseball pitches, like a pitcher, pitches, P-I-T-C-H-E-S, to Bolden, B-O-L-D-E-N, and make sure you find the one that has been uploaded by Quantum G, Q-U-A-N-T-U-M-G, that is Trent. And it doesn't have that many views yet, but again, it's from March 2nd, and Trent kind of outdid himself with some biting humor, so I'm going to mention it tomorrow night on Open Lines. Go check it out. Have some fun. And special thanks again to Eric Lerner. We're looking forward to talking to all of you tomorrow evening on Open Line, 7 p.m. California time. Goodbye from Eric Lerner and the Space Show.